concept that some people have trouble with, but you can tell it's really being used. I'd like you, Paul, for any other comments. WS? WS2N, H-U-L-I-W.
Okay, WS2N here. Copy all of that, and I'll definitely keep my ears open for possible wattage output, you know, on that equipment and other equipment. New Horizon is, yeah, I mean, that thing's out there now, too. You know, that's going to get to Pluto around 2015, and I had looked up time on that. It's a six-hour light transmission, you know. Yeah, years ago we were just like, wow, 6 hours. This thing is, you know, what is it, 16? 16 happening. So, it's amazing. These things are still functioning. Just wanted to comment on that launch, X-32. It's a manned launch, but it's being launched by the Russian Soyuz spacecraft. SpaceX is involved in that. They'll be launching people probably 4 or 5 years down the road. Right now, this the standard launch every 5 to 6 months. The Russians will put three up and bring three down. Back to six.
Pretty fine, Paul. Good information. Let me ask a quick question to John, KC2WGB. John, when you answer me, I'll be listening to you on the input frequency. I think you've made attempts in the past to transmit on 147.375 and maybe didn't come through this particular repeater, even though you had a 4ZPL. In fact, let me do that experiment right now. Yeah, sure enough. This repeater will not work without a 136.5. 4ZPL 136.5 is required, otherwise this repeater does not respond. So I think you've made multiple attempts in the past to transmit directly to this repeater from Staten Island, and I think you were not successful, John. I'm going to pass it back to you for a repeat on that. Also, sure, it would be nice if you had RRLP or an Echo Link that could get into this repeater. So give me your answer in the normal manner. I'll hear you on the input. KC2WGB, K2LIW on the TechNet. Roger, John. You said, can I hear this, Dick? And I'm hearing you very well, so go right ahead. I think you're not able to get to 147.375 from your location. Now, you don't have enough antenna and power you can aim in that direction over the hill. And I think you might not have the Echo Link or IRLP that can link into either of the repeaters. KC2WGB, KQRIW, listening on the input. Paul, if you're still there, WS2N, K2RIW. John is asking the question, do we know what the original bit rate of Voyager, if you're down to 160 bits per second now, they're at their extreme range, any idea what the original bit rate was? I'm going to guess it was something like a megabit per second, and then maybe even more than that. WS2N, K2RIW.
I know it was a big change. They said, data rate has slowed tremendously that we're down to, and he said 160 bits. And he said, he made the point. 160, I mean, he was talking about baud, which was roughly what, I think it would be like 8 instead of a bit would be 1, you know, something like that. He specifically said 160, but I got to find out the original. It's probably right, probably in the mega numbers. 1977 technology. What would that be? Something faster than an Amtor, I guess, or whatever we had back then.
Yeah, when it comes to bit rate and baud rate, I think bit rate and baud rate are almost the same. Byte rate, that takes 8 bits to make a byte, so you divide by 8 in order to... let's see, 8 into 160 would be 20 bytes per second, if I got that right. So if they were doing it in binary bytes, 160 bits per second is something like 20 bytes per second. And so But I think bid rate and board rate might be the same. Did Ed Stallone specifically say board rate of 160 on WS2N, K2IW?
Not a bid rate, no. No, I'm thinking fight rate, you know, 8-to-1 ratio, roughly. But the, no, he specifically said bid. At least 2 or 3 times.
Okay. And finally, the hams are talking about board rate. So a bid rate, we know, we're putting them, but you know what that is. So, once again, John, KC2WJB, I know that you've made an attempt to get through the 975, 375. Apparently, it didn't work, even though you got the PL turned on. Just not enough steam is going out there. It is a hell of a lot longer distance for you. Let me think. That repeater is 40 or so miles out from New York City, probably almost 50 miles from you, which is really down the road a piece. With a Yagi, you could do it. Yagi and 20 watts, but maybe you don't have a vertically polarized Yagi. You can aim in that direction. And I think at this time, you don't have IRLP or EchoLink that can get into either one of the machines. Is that true, Paul? All right, here we go, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
He needs about 10 more watts. I just get him on the input, and I'm in Rock Ackerman's in. Delta's what, another 10 miles out.
So you're hearing John on the input. Is that what you're saying, Paul?
I'm going to say 50%. I keep moving my antenna around, but he doesn't talk long enough, so I lose him.
Okay, so John does, but Paul hears you on the input, but the machine's another, I guess you said 20 miles out. Wait a minute now. From Kakama to Selgin.
That's about 10 miles.
I don't think it's even 10 miles, Paul. From Kakama to Selgin, oh yeah, your slant range, because when Kakama is further north. But in just plain east-west, I bet you there's only about 6 or 7 miles between the latitude, here we go, longitude of Von Kakama versus the longitude of Selden. And the repeater's up on a nice high tower, a nice high hill out there in Selden. So once again, John, I think you're saying you do not yet have EchoLink or IRLP, which I don't either, which is kind of silly. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the tech net.
He needs another 10, just to be safe, to be sorry. I mean, normally I don't hear him sick. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, probably the phone's far away. I could drive there in 10 minutes.
And you might also tell us, John, how many watts you're running. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2LIW, listening.
Hard to send copy that time.
Okay, well, you're up to 75 watts. Paul says he's getting 100% copy on you. Just for the hell of it, John. At 75 watts, with the antenna carefully aimed at where you think you're Selden, give it a try on 975-375. KC2WGB, give it a go. K2LIW. Boy, I heard you S9, but you didn't come through the machine. I didn't check, but I'm pretty sure you got the right PL turned on. Is that true, John? That's the right number. Okay, you gave it a good try. Nice and loud to me, but I'm a healthy 20 miles from the machine. However, that machine is higher up than I am, with more antenna gain. Kind of amazed it doesn't hear you. Is the antenna you're transmitting with, John, does it have aiming capability? Is it a vertically polarized Yagi, or is it the omnidirectional antenna? Over to you, John.
Comment that the frequency changed. It did something. I couldn't hear him on the input on that time going into Southland. But yet when he's on the other input, you know, 65, I hear him pretty good.
So once again, Paul, you heard John on the 25 input where he's transmitting right now. Is that what you're saying, John? I mean, Paul, you heard John on which frequency? WS2N, K2LIW?
Yeah, when he's on the input for Glen Oaks, I hear him, but when he's on the input for Selden, it's all static. It's really weird. So that change of frequency might do something. Might just...
Yeah, that's a little bit strange. The fact that you hear him so well when he transmits on 2.5, and you don't hear him when he transmits on... Are you sure you're listening on the input? 147, 975, and that 375. Back to you, Paul.
Duetta.
Okay. Is there anything that could be going on funny where when you're up, when you're transmitting on 975, 1.75, John, that your real power output is 2.5? I mean, percentage-wise, those frequencies are so close. The fact that Paul hears you so well on 625 and does not hear you on 147.
What kind of burning questions have we had so far this week, John? KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Okay, Dick, I don't know if you can copy me, but we'll give it a try. And by the way, my base of my antenna is above me, high, so I've got another 45 feet on top of that.
That's a nice altitude, and you're coming through very well, so please proceed.
All right, this is KC2WGB. This is Mel's Corner here with some questions. I have a young ham who wants to know the history of frequency shift keys. Like, why was it developed? And how, when, and is it similar to digital transmission? Because he's heard that reference, he thought, by you at one time. So he'd like a little explanation of the operation of FSK.
Okay. I'm not necessarily an expert on this, but I'm going to tell you what I know. And with the errors, people will be correcting me. The idea of transmitting a radio signal is primarily a choosing of frequency. You choose the right frequency, 1 megacycle, 3.5 megacycles, megahertz, 30 megahertz, 146 megahertz, and put it into the right kind of an antenna and the right amount of power, and you're transmitting a transverse electromagnetic wave. It's the so-called carrier, and that signal can be heard all long distance with the right kind of equipment. Mother Nature will propagate that signal. In the case of the Voyager, she'll propagate that signal 80 billion kilometers. However, the fact that the carrier is there is not enough. I could sit in front of a classroom as the teacher and whistle a 1 kilohertz note. Everybody with normal hearing in the room would know that I'm whistling. A carrier frequency coming out of my mouth, a 1 kilohertz note, is well received by everybody in that classroom with normal hearing. That's the good news. The bad news, I'm not conveying any information. Yeah, I'm letting you know I'm there. I'm letting you know I'm whistling. But I'm certainly not teaching you anything. So once you've got the signal that can get through by the so-called RF carrier, now you've got to do something to it to convey information. In the case of ordinary Morse code, you completely turn it on and off, which is a kind of amplitude modulation. In the case of more elaborate amplitude modulation, you can amplitude modulate in a way where the amplitude of the carrier goes up and down with the voltage of my voice coming out of a microphone, amplitude modulation. The other method of modulation is what's called angular modulation. Whether it be phase modulation or frequency modulation, both of those are lumped together as angular modulation. In other words, if you had an oscilloscope where you looked at the unmodulated signal on the upper trace, the middle trace oscilloscope, and the modulated signal was on the lower trace, you would see the sine wave of the lower trace move left and right as you're doing either phase or frequency modulation, angular modulation. Okay? Now, when it comes to on-off keying by Morse code, there's multiple ways you can do it. You could, if you want to, completely turn the carrier on and off, and for most of the frequencies we use, that works pretty well. If I was operating on the 10 gigahertz ham band, and the way you get there, in most cases, is to start off with a crystal-controlled oscillator, usually operating on the 5th or 7th overtone, where the crystal-controlled oscillator is running at approximately 100 to 110 megahertz is where the crystal-controlled oscillator is operating. You then put that through a bunch of frequency multiplier stages, and out comes 10,368 megahertz. If you took that particular crystal-controlled oscillator, no matter how high the quality of the crystal was, and if you turned that on and off right at the crystal oscillator, it would have a hell of a lot of swoop and droop and everything else to it. The Morse code would sound like would have a very weird sound. Every time you press down the key, it'd come on the air and the frequency would slowly slide to some other frequency. Somebody got the great idea of transmitting a kind of Morse code on these upper frequencies, and a good number of the beacons do this. The beacon literally has, across that oscillator, maybe a 1 picofarad capacitor that gets electronically switched on and off to that oscillator. So the frequency of the oscillator hops up and down, let me pick a number, 1 kilohertz at the 10,368 megahertz region by frequency shift keying. The advantage of frequency shift keying is that the oscillator version of what Vito was talking about earlier with his HQ120. So by frequency shift keying, I get some nice, clean sounding Morse code. If I set the receiver in such a way that one of the two frequencies it shifts to happens to be 0 beat on my receiver, and the other one was 1 KC away, I would hear 1 KC code, and depending on how I tune the receiver, I could hear the 1 KC note as Morse code that's either right side up or upside down, depending on whether I 0 beat the upper frequency or the lower frequency. Let me drop. But the other advantage of the frequency shift keying as a beacon is that if I set the receiver halfway between the upper frequency and the lower frequency, and if I've got the frequency shift, the IF shift control of my Kenwood 700 set correctly, so I can hear the upper sideband and the lower sideband alternately, I could then set the receiver midway between the two, so that during key down, it would be 500 hertz higher than my receiver. During key up, it would be 500 hertz lower than my receiver. I would hear a continuous tone of 500 hertz. Maybe I'd hear a little bit of clicking, but I'd hear no real difference between the key down and the key up. At first, it sounds like that's not an advantage. It's a huge advantage. If I'm trying to aim a 3-degree beamwidth parabolic dish antenna, and I'm listening to amplitude of signal, the fact that the amplitude of key down and key up sounds the same, and the tone sounds the same, while I'm swishing the antenna back and forth in azimuth by using my antenna rotator, it gives you a huge advantage, makes it very easy to peak the antenna on that signal. Also, if I'm tuning the receiver, let me drop. If I got my screwdriver inside of the receiver and I'm tuning the various stages, and I'm looking at some kind of a amplitude display, oscilloscope, Dawson dial movement, or whatever, the fact that the key down and key up gives me the exact same tone, the exact same amplitude, I can continuously watch the display device, whatever it is. It could be my hearing, it could be an oscilloscope, it could be a Dawson dial movement, and since there's a continuous signal there, key down and key up, while I'm operating and turning the controls of the receiver, you can see the advantage of doing that kind of tuning by an off-the-air beacon. These beacons, when guys on the microwave frequency set up a beacon, it's got a whole lot of advantages. Let you know when the band is open, let you know how well it's open, let you know whether or not you're getting Doppler shift because of a rain cloud going by, allows you to check the tuning and sensitivity of your receiver. So as you can see, frequency shift keying has another one of these advantages where a milliwatt or even less of power of the modulator could be modulating a kilowatt rate. That's the advantage of phase or FM, any of the angular modulation modes. And so the digital equivalent of angular modulated mode is frequency shift keying. There's also kinds of the very fancy frequency, the very fancy computer programs that can demodulate the frequency shift keyed signals and get tremendous improvement in signal-to-noise ratio advantage. In other words, a frequency shift signal with the right kind of digital signal processing will allow you to really dig into the noise. The weak signal Joe Taylor, WSJT mode, K1JT, invented these various digital-like modes. Some of them have some of the characteristics of frequency shift keying. So that's part of the story. There's a lot more to the story, but that's what little bit I know, and the guys who are most using today frequency shift keying are the microwave enthusiasts setting up these microwave beacon transmitters. KC2WGB, drag your gate, because somebody else with some more smarts on this subject is on the frequency and wants to let us know about it. K2IW.net. You got it after a little bit of delay, John.
KC2WGB. Yes, Nick. Old technology, it's been around a long time. It can be used for elevator controls, all kinds of remote control systems, and it does work as well, and it's fairly noisy here. So I see his reference. We have some history students tonight, because the next question is really going to throw you. It's right up your alley, Dick.
Fire when ready, John.
Okay, KC2WQB. Dick, this gentleman's taking in the history book. After the B-29, when we started to get into the jet age, there was a SAT bomber, B-47. It had two radar systems, one in the tail, one in the nose, and they both had a peripheral vision of 170 degrees. He'd like to know how that's possible. And at that time, Madison was a fish stick. So maybe you could just give him a quick synopsis of how something like that works.
Now, there's two different ways he could be talking about 170 degrees, and here I'm not sure. Is he saying that it would take, it would have a beam width of the antenna 170 degrees to the right and 170 degrees to the left? Or was he talking about 170 degrees total, which would be plus or minus 60-some-odd degrees? Wait a minute now. 170 plus or minus 85 degrees. So do you think he's talking about plus or minus 85, 170 total? What do you think he's talking about, plus or minus 170? What's your guess, John?
I think, just like your vision, total 170 degrees, which is quite extreme. And he was reading about that. He'd like to know how that's possible with the horns that they had at that time. Is it multiple horns, or what type of thing did they use to receive with that broad beam width? It's amazing.
Okay. Lots of different ways you can do this, depending on what you're trying to accomplish. It's easy to set up a vertically polarized monopole-like antenna. Rubber duck, quarter-wave ground plane, 5/8 wave ground plane. Any of those antennas have a horizontal beam width of 360 degrees, plus or minus 180, to cover every direction all the way around. As you start increasing the gain of the antenna in azimuth, remember that rule of thumb I gave you. You tell me how many wavelengths wide is the horn, dish, or whatever is emitting the signal. How many wavelengths wide it is. Divide that number of wavelengths into 70 degrees, and that's going to be the beam width of the antenna. So if my emitting surface had one wavelength of width, 1 divided into 70 is 70, I would have a 70-degree beam width. The most narrow beam width you're likely to use, the most narrow emitter, could be a piece of waveguide, an open-ended piece of waveguide. The waveguide would be right at the cutoff frequency if it is a half wavelength wide. If I divide half wavelength into 70 degrees, I end up with 140 degrees. An open-ended piece of waveguide with no flange on the end could, in theory, have a horizontal beam width of around 140 degrees. That's the direct approach of a very simple one-element emitter. Let me drop. Now, if I'm willing to set up a cluster of horns, I've got a whole bunch of horns all side by side set up in a circular pattern. By way of those horns, I could easily make 360 degrees of beam width. That's if I assume I had the right number of horns, all the mouths touching each other, all in a circular pattern, and nobody is forcing me to put equal power into all those horns. I could put less power into the horns in the rear of the antenna pattern and more power than the horns that aim into the forward section of the antenna pattern. So by adjusting the power phase, I could use those horns in all kinds of ways. I can make all kinds of antenna patterns. By using horns that have a fair amount of vertical gain but very little horizontal gain, these would be a bunch of horns that each individual horn would have very little width and a whole lot of height. I could therefore generate an antenna pattern that is a beaver tail in space. Very wide in azimuth, very narrow in elevation. So if you're smart enough in the way you design the antenna and you start using techniques like phased array techniques, multiple elements, you can generate essentially any kind of antenna pattern you can envision. You can make the horizontal beam width anything you want, the vertical beam width anything you want, the polarization characteristics, horizontal, vertical, clockwise, counterclockwise, elliptical, plant 45 right, plant 45 left. If you're smart enough in the way you design the antenna, anything you can envision, anything you can put on paper, is possible to produce. Now, let me drop.
Perfect, Gary. Fantastic.
In the case of putting a radar on the back of the airplane and a radar on the front, the next question would be, why in the world would you put one on the back? Who cares about what you're looking at, where you used to be? They'd like to look at where you're going. So, in general, you would think that the radar up front is the most important one. That tells me I'm about to run into a rain cloud, I'm about to smash into somebody else's airplane, or into a mountainside. So the radar up front, in most guys' minds, is the one that's most important. Well, I worked on the tail warning radar of the B-1 bomber program, and the tail warning radar was very important because there are certain scenarios in which somebody is going to shoot a surface-to-air missile or an air-to-air missile at you, and the missile is going to be crawling up your tail. So the tail warning radar is a very important radar. And once your tail warning radar says, uh-oh, something's on the way, it's moving fast, it's coming up your tail, and it's moving 3 times faster than you are, and it's going to be here in 7 seconds. The tail warning radar, in theory, can give you that information. In which case, the electronics on board, the automatic system, and the pilot, all kinds of warnings go off, and defensive measures begin. It might be throwing out chaff, it might be throwing out a decoy, it might be turning on a particular jamming transmitter, it might be violent, evasive aerodynamic maneuvers. The tail warning radar gives you a very valuable piece of information that if you don't do something, something real bad is going to happen real soon. So radars up front, radars up back, how far they have to cover in azimuth and elevation, these are all important parameters depending on where does your airplane fly. Does it skim the surface? Does it fly high? Is it flying into an environment where a lot of missiles are going to be launched at you from the nose, or launched at you from the side, or launched at you from the tail? As you can tell, there's all kinds of electronic countermeasures and counter-countermeasures you might install on that airplane. So making a particular antenna pattern, if you're smart enough, is almost easy. And because of the scenario in which that airplane is going to fly, there's a whole lot of particular antenna patterns you might desire. KC2WGB, K2RW in the TechNet.
All right,
Dick.
Excellent explanation. Yeah, the tail radar in the T-47, if I remember correctly, is for fighter interceptor detection. They had problems with that in Korea with the MiGs that used to come in vertically in the dead zone above the aircraft. It would not be detected. So that was an important thing that they developed. And I didn't know it was used in the B-1, but I assume that there's probably more that I don't know about the B-1. But interesting stuff for that time. I don't even think we had, other than solid fuel rockets, which went very short distances, so I don't think they were too worried about rockets at that time. But good explanation, Dave.
That's only a fraction of the story, but it gets you rolling. Go ahead with the next one, John.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, I have a 13-year-old amateur, going to be an amateur soon, has a question on resistors. I guess from his science class. All right, he wants to know, on the molecular level, how does it work? Do they slow down the electrons? What does a resistor do? Why do they work? Does the speed change on the electron? What's going on? So maybe you can give them a quick transition of a resistor thing.
You got to be careful when somebody tells you the speed of the electrons are such and such. Remember now the example that I've given. It's a little bit off to one side, but it proves a point. Assume that on the Burke automobile, KC2WGB's automobile, he's got this real good super car battery. He's about to turn on the starter motor. And by some magic, he's studying the red electron that's coming out of the negative lead of the car battery right now. That red electron is going to travel down this wide piece of copper braid that connects over to, I'm simplifying things, over to the starter motor. So at the instant he turns the key, from the time that solenoid makes contact, and now the battery voltage is connected to the starter motor, and the starter motor is starting to turn over, that instant, that action takes place in nanoseconds. In other words, from the instant the contacts close until the starter motor senses that the voltage has arrived and it's time to start moving, that occurs in nanoseconds, because the length of the cable is 3 feet long in my example, and because the speed of light is 1 nanosecond per foot, the battery knows about the action of closing the contacts in roughly 3 nanoseconds. That's the truth. And so you could say that the electrons, from that point of view, appear to move at the speed of light down that cable. That's one way of looking at it. But now let's look at what's happening to that red electron. Assuming now in my example that the electron that I'm studying, I painted it with red paint, and I'm watching this red electron leave the car battery, and it's about to crawl down the...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
It's about to crawl down that very wide piece of copper braid between the car battery and the starter motor, and I'm watching that red electron. How long does it take for him to get there? The answer is approximately 4 hours. I know you're going to be skeptical of that. If you go to a very well-respected book by Epstein, it's called Thinking Physics. You go to your Amazon or your Barnes & Noble or in the old days, Border Store, and you go to the book called Thinking Epstein by Thinking Physics by Mr. Epstein. I'm having trouble thinking of his first name right now. You'll see a whole bunch of physics examples with nice diagrams and things like this. What's really happening is that the total number of free electrons that are in that copper cable is a huge number, something like Avogadro's number. And so it's like a tremendous number of marbles in a pipe. As such, you push one marble into the input end of the pipe, and in an extremely short period of time, a marble pops out of the back end of the pipe, but your particular marble takes a whole lot of time to go down that pipe. Water going into a hose, marbles going into a pipe, or electrons going into a cable are like that. So if Mother Nature would allow you to do it, you could drain the electrons out of that piece of copper cable. You could drain 200 amperes of locked rotor load out of that copper piece of wire in between the car battery and the starter motor. You could drain 200 amperes out of it without having any input if Mother Nature would allow you to create that amount of imbalance. She won't let you do that. As soon as you take a couple of electrons out of the tail end, she insists you put a couple of electrons in the front end. Otherwise, she's going to say, no current's going to flow. You're going to supply some new marbles into the pipe when you take some out of the back end. Alrighty. Now in that piece of copper tubing, in that piece of copper wiring in between the car battery and the starter motor, I cut the cable and I install something called a resistor. Real electronics that you and I set up on our table, the real resistors we put on are 10 ohms, 100 ohms, 1,000 ohms, million ohms. In the electronics that you and I set up between our transistors and our integrated circuits, your ohm meter is going to measure some reasonably large number of ohms. Let me drop. And in a minute I'll explain what that means. But in the case of a car battery, because it is such a very high current circuit, you could be putting in a resistor of only a few milliohms, a very small value resistor. I'm not talking about its physical size. I'm talking about its electrical parameter called ohms, a very small number of ohms. You could be putting into that cable going to the starter motor, and you would certainly slow down the starter motor, and or you would lower the amount of torque it has, and maybe it would no longer move the car motor. What the resistor does, it does not slow down the velocity of the electrons. Remember that red electron is going to take 4 hours to go through the piece of wire and go into the starter motor. Well, if I put a resistor in between, and if I readjust things so that resultant current is almost the same, or the resultant voltage is the same, the amount of time it would take for the red electron to go through the wire, through the resistor, and get to the starter motor would be almost the same. So it's not speed. It's a little bit similar to water flowing through a hose, and you squeeze the middle of the hose. I walk over to the hose, and with my hand or with a pair of pliers, I squeeze the hose so it doesn't have as much diameter. I have created a resistance. The amount of water that flows through the hose would be less. In that case, I'd really be slowing down the water. You don't necessarily slow down the resistors. I mean, if you measure the amount of time that I close the switch at the, so assume I've got an on-off switch at the car battery. I've got an on-off switch at the car battery, and I close the switch, and I measure how long it takes for the response of that 3-foot-long piece of cable to go into the starter motor, even though I put a great big resistor in between. The action at the far end, I'm going to decrease the amount of action, not as much current will flow, the starter motor will not run as fast, or not produce as much torque, but still the timing would be the same, as long as I haven't made a great big long resistor. If the resistor is some reasonable length, from the time I close the switch at the car battery until the starter motor would sense that I've done that, would still be 3 nanoseconds, even with the resistor. So the rate at which the marbles flow in the pipe and the number of marbles could be slowed down, but the speed of response could be the same. So does the resistor change timing? In that example, no. However, if I'm making a resistor capacitor circuit, I've now got a switch that goes into a resistor. The far end of the resistor has got a capacitor that goes to ground, and I'm measuring the voltage across that capacitor. I've now got what's called an RC time delay network. And you could draw a curve, an exponential rising voltage curve of voltage on the capacitor versus time after I close the switch. And as I use a bigger and bigger resistor, I'm supplying a smaller and smaller current into the capacitor. Therefore, the rate of change of voltage on the capacitor will be slower. And in that case, because of the characteristics of the RC network, now the bigger resistor will charge the capacitor more slowly. Did I slow down the electrons going through the resistor? No. The response time of closing the switch and the capacitor senses that something's happening, it's still going to be the same number of nanoseconds. But the resistor itself, by its choking action, I'm trying to have trouble using what words now, it's going to charge the capacitor more slowly. So there are cases where the resistor appears to slow down your circuit. But is it really slowing down the response time of the electron? No. I'm going to try to give you one more example here. Let me drop. And the next example is, what's really happening at the molecular level? At the molecular level, I could make up a connection between the input end of the resistor and the output end of the resistor, and I'm doing it with a whole bunch of individual strands of, let me pick a number, 40 gauge wider. And I use, in my first resistor, I use 50 pieces of 40 gauge wire between the input end and the output end of my resistor. And I decide that, yeah, that's giving me 1 ohm, if I add it all up just right, as 1 ohm measured on my ohm meter. And now I ask the question, what will happen if I take those 50 individual strands of 40 gauge wire and I cut 25 of them? I've got half the number of strands. I've now got twice as much resistance. The amount of time for an electron to go through is the same, but now it's got half the number of paths. Therefore, in this example, it would have twice the number of ohms of resistance. And if I was charging a capacitor with that 25 strands instead of 50 strand resistor, the capacitor would charge take twice as long to do it. It'd be running a lot slower. So cutting away some of the parallel paths is one of the ways of adjusting a resistor. You literally can take a carbon composition resistor. Let me drop. You literally put a carbon composition resistor on a Wheatstone bridge and now you can take a X-Acto knife or a Dremel tool and start cutting a notch in the side of the resistor, and you're doing this while measuring the number of ohms. You're cutting away some of those parallel paths that are inside of this bulk effect device, and you will watch the number of ohms. You will watch the number of ohms increase as you do that, as you cut that value. And people make a precision resistor that do exactly that. They literally cut a notch in the side of the resistor to adjust the number of ohms. This is not the whole story, but it gives you some of the story. I think I'll be able to hear you on the input, John, so go ahead and transmit. And so we'll be slowed down a little bit, but we'll still continue this conversation. KC2WGB, H2RIW on the tech desk.
We can't hear you, Kevin.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick. Yeah, I had to do that many times, especially with the voltmeters, the Simpson 260, special edition from there, when they said that, exactly what we did. And 4-to-1 resistance, you take 3-to-1 water at that point, and that's exactly what you were going to do. However, this young man is asking, what specifically happens? Why does carbon reduce the current? What happens inside of that? Why is it that there's not enough donor material for the electrons to activate? Or that's where his confusion is. He's got a pretty good grip on the function of resistors, but how they actually operate. So maybe you could touch a little bit more on that molecular level.
Yeah, some of this has got to do with what materials you use. Aluminum has a lot more resistance than does silver or copper. If I use aluminum wiring in my house or in my power wiring going down the street, I've got to use a much larger diameter of wire because there's something about the basic characteristics of aluminum that it has more of this thing that we call resistance compared to copper. You could say the number of free electrons that are on each individual molecule of the copper versus the number of free electrons that are in the molecules of the aluminum. That's one way of looking at it. How closely packed are the individual molecules? Maybe that's a particular factor. So each material has its own amount of resistivity. So choosing the material chooses the resistance. Choosing the diameter of the material. If I have a piece of aluminum wire going between my pole pig transformer and my house, and I go over there by some means, and I cut down the diameter of the wire, which is similar to what I did in my earlier experiment, where I had 50 strands and I cut away some of those strands. Now the amount of resistance that you measure with an ohm meter goes up. The amount of electrons that flow with a standard voltage decrease to the resistance, the number of decreases, a little bit similar to putting a pair of pliers in the middle of my garden hose. From the time I open up the faucet on the garden hose until water flows out of the nozzle at the far end is always the same, assuming the garden hose was filled with water to begin with. But the rate at which the water flows down the hose becomes a much lower rate when I squeeze it down with pliers. That person, again, is within 1 mile of the repeater. He's roughly S3 at my house, and I can tell by signal strength he is within approximately 1 mile of the repeater. He's in a very small piece of real estate. You should be able to pin him down. So, when you choose materials, you choose the diameter of the materials, you're choosing the number of ohms of resistance that that chunk of material gives you. So, using real quality materials like copper or silver lowers the resistance. Choose some of these really fancy materials and cryogenically cool them, you run into a characteristic called the superconductivity, where all resistance disappears. That's not an easy one to explain. At the molecular level, you could call it a kind of choking action, similar to putting a pair of pliers on the garden hose. That's part of what resistance is. The analogy between mechanical things like garden hose and a real electronic resistor, some of those analogies break down a little bit. They're not a one-to-one relationship. You've got to be careful how you judge those. So choking down, changing the diameter, that gives you some of the understanding, some of the characteristic, but it's not the whole story. I'm trying to think of a better way of explaining it. Choking action is part of it, but it's not speed per se. Speed of the electrons going through doesn't change. The number of electrons that can get through the smaller number of strands in my 50 strand versus 25 ohm, 25 strand resistor, or the number of water molecules that get through my garden hose that I squeeze down with a pair of pliers, there's a fairly strong analogy there, fairly strong one-to-one relationship. Ohm's law gives you the mathematics of how many volts, how many ohms, and how many amps. And so these ohms, volts, and amps are very nicely related by the equation E equals IR or I equals E over R. And there's also variations of that formula that allow you to calculate how many watts of flow taking place. In theory, when you squeeze down that garden hose with the pliers, the water flowing through that area of the garden hose, if you had a careful measurement with a thermometer, part of the garden hose would run hotter because of the way you squeeze things down and the way the water molecules have to go through that smaller aperture. By the same token, when you put a certain amount of volts across the resistor and a certain amount of you develop heat in the resistor, I squared R is one way of rating the number of the resistor. This is only there's a lot more to the cell. I think you can overcome better than I can, John. KC2W in the TechNet.
Took a little long, but I'm sure.
These days at Amazon or Borders or Barnes & Noble, and that book is in its third, it's in its third edition, and the 27th edition. Obviously, it's a very popular book. Each time somebody discovers that and tells his friends about it, his friends who have it, I own two or three different editions because as he made a later edition, and I fell in love with the first or second edition, I have no trouble with spending another $33 and getting the third edition, which has, a 20% increase in the number of puzzles. I was always hoping that the really smart physics teachers in colleges or in high schools would teach physics in the manner of Lewis Carroll Epstein, his book called Thinking Physics, where you've got a simple diagram on each individual page and you ask multiple choice questions, what do you think is going to happen in this situation? As a method of teaching physics, in my opinion, it's extremely effective because man is an animal. And as a visual animal, you see that picture of what's taking place and you do a very good job of remembering it and how it works. Just memorizing a bunch of equations and learning how to manipulate the individual components of an equation really doesn't teach physics, in my opinion. It's a great big memorization. You pass the test. A week later, you forget because in your mind, there's a picture and any way of remembering and relating it to something. If you're going to remember something, you to something that you were mankind really remembers things, related to something you're and that you're already interested in. And the visualization. I'm going to stand by for a few minutes. K2RIW. This guy is within 1 mile of that. He's in a very of real estate. He should be very easy to pin dial. He's within 1 mile of that repeater. I can tell by signal strength on the input. K2RIW. He's running S3 at my house right now.
Approximately 1 mile.
It's a very small piece of real estate.